now open and call a meeting to order. I believe we have a quorum, and we'll proceed to hear a public hearing on House Bill 2215. It looks like we have three sets of witnesses. Looks like everyone may be in favor, but I can't tell for sure. So would the first the representative from the Department of Justice come forward and introduce yourself to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Lee, I'm Assistant Attorney General for the State of Oregon, and I do have written testimony, if I may provide it to the clerk.
Have we been provided that already?
I don't believe so.
Okay, I'm thinking of another bill. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name again is David Lee, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. And I'm here to testify on behalf of the department in support of HB 2215. This bill seeks to clarify the appropriate venue in lawsuits against the state. As the committee is probably aware, venue is generally a protection for the defendant against being hauled into court in a far-flung jurisdiction. In suits against the state, like suits against other defendants, the knowledgeable officials and are generally the state official. The knowledgeable witnesses will generally be the state officials or the state workers who actually are located, officed in the county where the cause of action arose. So, for instance, if there's a traffic accident in Baker County, then the knowledgeable state workers are in all likelihood going to be officials who are housed in Baker County. To bring a cause of action based on that traffic accident in Baker County, in Multnomah County, or in some other county in the Willamette Valley would obviously create a serious burden on the agency to send its witnesses to Multnomah County to Portland for the trial, to appear as witnesses. The purpose of this bill is to eliminate what's been seen as form shopping, frankly, on the part of the plaintiff's bar, where the state tends to be sued in Multnomah County for causes of action that have no connection whatsoever with Multnomah County, and the state is put to the expense of bringing its witnesses to trial in Portland. The bill, as drafted, accomplishes that purpose. It also accomplishes another sort of side purpose, which is the previous version of 14060 included the term cause of suit, which at the time the statute was initially drafted, suit could be interpreted as distinct from a cause of action, and the distinction being equity versus law. So it's come into question whether 14060, as it currently stands, may be limited to only cases in equity, suits, rather than actions at law, money damage actions. So the current drafting of HB 2215 addresses that issue by replacing causes of suit as it currently appears in 14060 with causes of action, which is generally understood now as encompassing any civil suit.
Right. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, Judge Lipscomb.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Lipscomb. I'm the presiding judge, Marion County Circuit Court. And with me at the table here this morning is Bruce Miller. He's the next on your list. He's with the State Court Administrator's Office. And he's up here making sure that I don't make any egregious errors this morning. We are not opposing this bill, and we're not in favor of this bill. I'm just here to relay some concerns. What's being proposed is a shift of workload, frankly, from the Multnomah County Circuit Court and perhaps some other courts out there in other jurisdictions to Marion County Circuit Court once again. And I would just like to point out that we're already overburdened with work. We have more caseload than resources, and we have put in for additional judicial positions last session and again this session, and there's only so much that can be squeezed through the bottle, and the neck of the bottle is still the same size that it was 6 years ago. And so it's really a resource issue for us. It's really what I'm here to tell you. We're not opposing the bill. We're concerned about the extra workload that will come our way. And other than that, we're always pleased to be doing the very best we can for everyone in the state of Oregon as well as our local residents.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Grog.
Judge, what are we really talking about? I mean, how many new cases would this...
We've been trying to get a handle on that since the issue first came to our attention, frankly, a couple of days ago. I think I learned about it Friday. We don't really know. I don't think that it's going to be overwhelming. Probably somewhere in the area of 15 cases a year, give or take two or three cases, is what I'm hearing from the Department of Justice. It could be more than that. It's just hard to imagine. What we're actually trying to do is predict human behavior and the human behavior of plaintiff's trial lawyers in terms of where they file. If everything else stays the same and those Multnomah County cases that they're concerned about simply shift to Marion County, we're probably looking at 12 to 15 cases. But the other thing that's happening in the statute, if this amendment goes through, it's basically creating a safe harbor for lawyers. They look at the statute and they say, well, where can we file this case? Oh, it says right on its face it can be filed in Marion County. That kind of becomes, well, let's just file in Marion County. I don't know how often that sort of thing will happen. I would imagine, frankly, not too much, but it's enough to make us nervous because, as I indicated before, we're already overworked, and we need more help. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative McPherson.
Judge Lipscomb, I'm not sure whether this but maybe is a question I should have put to Mr. Leaf because it sounds like they're the ones who designed the bill language, but
we're friends. Do you want him back up here?
I'll let you make that decision. I'll let me present the question to you, and you could invite him if you think you'd like to do that. I'm trying just to understand how the language change affects what's really happening here, because the old language in 14060 says that suit, I'm paraphrasing here, may be brought in the county wherein the cause of suit or some part thereof arose, and then that's being stricken, and now there's been being replaced with language that says that suits must be commenced in Marion County or in the county in which the cause of action arises. So it would recognize there's some difference in language. It looks like the place the cause of action arose is, under both old and new language, is a permissible place to bring a lawsuit, and that to that we're adding Marion County. Now, is there something about this? Maybe Mr. Leaf, maybe you'd be best to respond to that.
I'll defer to Mr. Leaf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson. I think that you've focused on exactly the key term in the existing statute and in the proposed bill, the may versus must be. It's been the Department of Justice's position that the apparently permissive may, in fact, means that you if indeed you are going to sue the state, then this is where you must sue them. You're obviously not required to sue the state. That's at least an ambiguous statute, though, and we think that it would be helpful to clarify that it's not permissive, that it's not just one place where you may sue the state is the county where the cause of suit arose, or Marion County, but in fact those are the only places where you can sue the state for in a civil action. So replacing the may with the must be is really the key change in that respect. If I could also back up to Representative Garrard's question, Mr. Chair, regarding the additional burden with the committee's permission. We did conduct an informal survey of our new cases over the last 4 months and looking to see how many cases appeared to have been arguably improperly filed in Multnomah County. And we found 5 cases that appeared to be filed in Multnomah County, although the cause of the action arose in a different county. Of those, 2 seem to have been causes of action that actually arose in Marion, so Marion would potentially have been the appropriate venue for those cases under our view of 14060 as it currently stands, and also under the bill. 3 others were in other counties, arose in other counties apart from Marion or Multnomah, and were filed in Multnomah. Those 3 would potentially be under this House bill, would potentially be subject to venue in Marion County. So that's admittedly not a scientific survey, but that sort of gives us a ballpark, and I think that's where Judge Lipscomb was coming from with the estimate he provided of the annualized additional burden that Marion County might expect. It's probably also worth mentioning, though, that those cases wouldn't necessarily be filed in Marion as opposed to the county in which this cause of action arose under this bill. The plaintiff, if the plaintiff was denied the Multnomah County venue, they wouldn't necessarily choose Marion rather than the county in which the cause of suit arose, the cause of action.
Meaning that if this bill passed and a claim was filed against the state in Multnomah County, the court would have 2 choices, Marion County or the county where the action arose?
That's correct.
So it would be automatically referable to Marion County Circuit Court?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gerard.
Mr. Lee, why even make Marion County? Why not just make the bill that you have to file in the county where the incident occurred?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, I think that's a fair question, and it's really more historical practice, I think, than anything else that leads us to concede that Marion County is the seat of government, is a proper place to sue the state in any event. That's been the department's position historically. We've never moved to change venue out of Marion County that I'm aware in a civil action. It's a matter of historical practice. It's not necessarily, perhaps it's a policy decision for this committee and then the Legislative Assembly as a whole, whether Marion County as the seat of government should be an appropriate venue in all cases, or whether a plaintiff should be limited, in fact, to the county in which the cause of action arose.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you for Mr. Leaf. You indicated you have done some background with about 4 months of cases that were filed. Do you have any others like a year profile and other counties in the state?
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, the only survey we did was the 4 months, and as I said, that was an informal survey. In fact, it was we did it just in the last couple of days in response to concerns raised by Judge Lipscomb about whether this might not impose a significant additional workload on the Marion County Circuit Court. If the committee would be interested in us expanding the survey and looking at a whole year, then we'd certainly be willing to do that.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. Along with that, then, your primary concern, as I understand it, is the cases that are being filed in Multnomah County because of shopping. Are there other counties that are brought to your attention which might be of concern?
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, no, we're not aware of lawsuits being filed in any other county other than Multnomah, despite the lack of connection to the case.
Thank you.
Further questions from the panel, from the committee?
Could I weigh in on one thing that...
Certainly, Judge.
Representative, thank you, Chair. Representative Garrard, you raised the issue as to whether we should simply do away with the language in this bill related to Marion County. This, and I was going to let Bruce Miller talk about this, but this bill really represents sort of the tip of the iceberg. This isn't the only place in the statutes where Marion County is given sort of a special status. I think there are something in the area of roughly 40 or 50, maybe even 60 separate statutes out there that make special venue provisions for Marion County with respect to state legislation or state business of one kind or another. And we thank you for the high regard in which you hold us.
The short answer to that is the legislature dumps a lot of cases on the Marion County Circuit Court.
That's how I interpreted that statement.
I can say it that way. Let me just ask the representative from the Department of Justice, isn't it a sort of the premise of venue that venue is proper perhaps when you have that more and more contacts with that particular jurisdictional base of the county, like, and that's why usually claims are filed where the action arose in that county.
Mr. Chair,
let me just make sort of another question behind that. If this statute is or bill was passed, it would be cases, if referred to Marion County, would have no contact with the facts of the case or necessarily the witnesses. Wouldn't that be true?
Mr. Chair, that possibility would certainly arise under the House bill. I think just to back up as to the purposes of venue, I think that the chair accurately described one purpose of venue that you generally, and it's associated with convenience, I believe, it makes sense to allow venue where the cause of action arose because that's likely to be where the witnesses are located. Venue is a doctrine of convenience and fairness to the defendant, though, and where the defendant resides is typically a place where venue has been provided for civil actions, and that's in part, I think, why the Department of Justice has historically conceded venue in the seat of government in Marion County.
And while you're back, last question, the cases on mandamus, does that involve this issue? I guess it does. You raise it. Could you clarify what that case is going to decide?
Mr. Chair, yes. I'm not as familiar with Nibbler versus ODOT as perhaps I should be, but it is typical of what we see in a lot of these cases. The cause of action arose in another county. The plaintiff's attorney is a Portland lawyer, I believe, and the plaintiff is, I believe, also a Portland resident. Brought the lawsuit in Multnomah County based on a cause of action that arose elsewhere, and I believe it was a traffic issue, although I'm not certain. The state moved to transfer venue to the county in which the cause of action arose, and the Multnomah County Circuit Court denied that motion. So the state petitioned the Supreme Court for a writ of mandamus. The Supreme Court granted the alternative writ and has held oral argument, but has not yet issued a ruling. So that case will potentially clarify what 14060 means. And in fact, it was the oral argument in Nibbler that highlighted or brought to light the issue about the cause of suit as opposed to the cause of action. One of the justices at oral argument pointed out that 14060 provides that the lawsuit may be filed in the place where the cause of suit arose. The Supreme Court justice inquired whether that didn't limit the statute's applicability to cases in equity. Nibbler potentially will resolve what 14060 means, but where a venue should be provided in a lawsuit against the state in going into the future is a matter of policy for the Legislative Assembly.
Fine, thank you. I don't have any other witnesses that are either, yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Miller from the Office of the State Court Administrator. We haven't taken a position on this bill. Late last week, I started to talk with the Attorney General's office to try to find out what the numbers meant in this case, and because of the press of business and being late in the week, we didn't get any numbers. This morning's the first time we've gotten numbers on what it may mean. We'd like to have a chance to explore that so that we can assess what the impact is going to be of this. A lot of the talk's been about Multnomah County, but you can see the way this is drafted. It's very broad. It's really any of these cases, wherever they're filed, can be brought in Marion County. As a little context to what Judge Lipscomb told you about the venue statutes, of the 50 or so venue statutes that allow venue in Marion County, half of those are mandatory. The case must be brought in Marion County. The other half are like this statute where it can be Marion County or county where the action arose. We would just like a little bit of time on this if we could to take a closer look at the numbers so that we can give you a better idea of what the impact will be on the resource shift.
Fine, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I have a question for Mr. Miller. The main impact of this bill, it appears to me, is to change, it's claimed to be a change, from a rule in which a case could be brought, may be brought in the county where the action arose, but may also be brought elsewhere. And it's been represented to us that cases were being brought in Multnomah County because it's a principal place of business for the state, and this would limit it. So there's this issue about whether Marion County would be an option. But quite aside from that, the claim is that this will change the rule. Do you understand it to be as the department representative has indicated, that is that currently a case can be brought any place in the state where the state can be intended to be a principal place, have a principal place of business?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, yes, to the extent that they can establish the appropriate contacts with that county, and that would depend on the particular case and which entity was involved. As presented, I think the bill, they're probably right that most of this is going to come out of Multnomah County, but we're not really sure about that. And if you listen to the numbers that he gave, three were from other counties, four from Marion County that were filed in places that they felt were inappropriate. So if your question is where will the most of them come from, it may well be Marion County, but I think they're, depending on the case, it could be in any one of the counties, depending on which entity is being sued and what their contacts are.
Follow-up. It wasn't so much what the actual flow of cases is going to be, but what I'm understanding is that this would change the rule. That's that the rule in the past has allowed cases to be brought other than where the cause of action arose, and we're being urged to adopt is a statute that would limit it to the place where the cause of action arose, or Marion County. And do you agree with the premise that current law allows a case to be brought in a county other than where the action arose?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, Judge Lipscomb informs me that Multnomah County judges have so ruled. But I think you're right, that it does make that change. And it's also a bit of social engineering when you put Marion County into the statute. It's the first thing you see, and so you're directing people there and away from any other county where it might be. But I think you're right, it may change it so it's only cause of action Marion County, not contacts that the state has in the other county.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, could
yes,
I
please
clarify just 2 points quickly? Mr. Miller, sort of reiterating the results of our informal survey, said three lawsuits in other counties and four in Marion. There's actually five total and two in Marion County that we identified as having been potentially improperly filed in Multnomah. So not four in Marion, just two. And the other thing is, it certainly it's certainly in the Legislative Assembly's prerogative to eliminate the Marion County provision in the alternative, but I just wanted to be clear that that would be the venue is typically a right of the defendant, which can be waived, and it has been our practice to not object to venue in Marion County. So allowing venue in Marion County is not actually going to, I wouldn't look at that as increasing the workload necessarily of the Marion County Circuit Court, because we haven't been objecting to those lawsuits anyway.
Thank you. Further discussion? Questions from the committee? Since there's no other persons in the audience either for or against, I'll close the public hearing and move immediately to a work session on this bill. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Girard.
I can't support the bill the way it's written, in that I don't think that Marion County should be even an alternate. I believe the cause, it should occur where the cause of action occurred.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Flores.
I, for one, would like to see a little more expanded data about the potential impact going back at least a year.
Right. Further discussion? I think our choice, one choice would be to refer the bill to the committee and with a do not pass recommendation and let the folks come back with their data at that time, Mr. Chair, or we can keep it here and process it further. Would you rather move it up?
Yeah, move it up.
Okay. Then we need a motion to refer the bill to the full committee with a do not pass recommendation, if that's a consensus of the committee. Someone would like to make that motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2215 to the full Judiciary Committee with a do not pass recommendation.
Further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
I guess the ayes have it, and I'll designate Representative Girard as the carrier to the full committee. We will then close the work session and open a public hearing on House Bill 2221. And if the proponents would come forward, that would be helpful. I only have one witness indicated, representative from the Department of Justice, I believe. Good morning. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Marshall Brogy. I'm the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account Program Coordinator, and I'm with the Department of Justice.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2221, and briefly this bill relates to the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account. A brief history of that account. This account was passed with initial legislation between the years 1989 and 1993, and then in January of 2002, at the direction of the legislation, the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account was moved from the Department of Human Services over to the Department of Justice. The Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account provides for primarily four things. We provide for a coordinated, community-based response to child abuse by creating multidisciplinary teams. We also mandate that local child fatality review teams are in place as well. There is also established by legislation an advisory council on child abuse assessment. And then the last piece has been to support the development of community-based child abuse intervention centers and regional training centers throughout the state. Typically, the activities noted above take place in the form of my program, the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program, making grant awards to the counties. And those awards are from the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account, which was created as a separate account and is presently overseen by the Department of Justice. Funds from this account are distributed to the multidisciplinary teams in the form of biennial grants, and they do that through an application process. And presently, all 36 counties have local multidisciplinary teams and child fatality review teams. And currently, there are also 19 child abuse intervention centers that are operational throughout the state, which provide services to approximately 4,000 children annually who have been victims of child abuse or child sex abuse. The proposed changes before you today reflect those changes that have been reviewed by the Advisory Council on Child Abuse Assessment, also by the Crime Victims Assistance Section of Department of Justice, interested community partners, and the Department of Justice, and they further update and clarify the statute. The changes requested in House Bill 2221 are in response primarily to the evolution and development of the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account over time, and they're not intended to make significant changes from the current practice, but to contribute to and enhance the current good work being done. Thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Fine, thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Just for my information, what's the source of funding that comes into the account that's then being dispersed?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the funding currently comes through the Criminal Fines and Assessment Account, also known as the Criminal Fines and Public Safety Fund. And those are funds that are paid as unitary assessments, in essence criminals, people who are convicted of crimes. Those fines go into that program and then are allocated to the Crime Victims Assistance Section Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is this bill generally reaction to the rather high-profile child abuse cases we've seen in Oregon in the past 18 to 24 months?
Mr. Chair, not specifically. Primarily, this bill is cleaning up language. Where you could indicate that the bill supports the teams in assessing what they're currently doing individually, as there is a section in the bill as proposed that recommends to the teams that they provide a method for review and analysis of how the whole team is functioning within their county. Each of the 36 teams has developed protocols that they follow for child abuse investigation. And as part of those protocols, we're asking them, meaning the Department of Justice is asking them, to take that extra step and to have local practices in place for review of those process and protocols.
Fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you remind me what percentage of child abuse cases in the state of Oregon every year are due to threat of harm as opposed to physical violence?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I do not know that specifically. I could look that up.
Okay, thank you.
And you're looking for threat of harm?
Further questions from the committee? Anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak to this bill, pro or con? Since there's no further testimony, I'll close the public hearing and move to work session. Committee members, discussion or a motion? The chair will move that House Bill 2221 be referred to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion from the committee? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Norris?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Motion carries. We need a carrier. So anyone have an interest in this bill? Representative Worth, you may take it. Thank you very much. Then I'll close the work session on this bill and move to the last one on our docket this morning and open a public hearing on House Bill 2230. Proponents can come to the microphones, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Proceed in any manner you wish. Just to state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I'm an assistant attorney general,
and presently assigned as Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I have written testimony that has been passed out. I am here to testify in favor of House Bill 2230. House Bill 2230 is proposed by the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. It provides for three clarifications to current restitution law in order to give the courts aid in providing restitution for victims of crime. First, it substitutes for the vague term pecuniary damages the term economic damages as defined in ORS 31710. Courts and litigants have struggled with the definition of pecuniary damages, and the introductory sentence of pecuniary damages will give an example of why. Pecuniary damages are defined as all special damages, but not general damages, which a person may recover in a civil action. ORS 31710, the definition of economic damages, actually has a list of the specific types of damages that can be considered to be economic damages. Second, the bill provides for clarity in the definition of who is a victim for the purpose of a restitution award. A victim is defined as the actual person against whom the crime was committed, and then all others who have suffered economic damages as a result of a crime. What this does is clarify some confusion in the courts as to whether or not insurance companies or crime victims who are third-party payers who have paid the actual victim of a crime can be included as part of the restitution award. Finally, the bill provides for an order of payment if there are multiple victims. First, the payment goes to the actual victim of the crime, next to the criminal injuries compensation account, and then to all others who have suffered an economic or suffered economic damages as a result of the criminal action. Attached to my written testimony is a hand-engrossed version of 2230. Because of the press of time, we didn't get the final amendments through a legislative council. And we do have three minor clarifications to the current bill. First, Section 5 of the bill is identical to Section 4 of the bill, and therefore I believe it should be deleted, or we'll have two sections saying the same thing in the ORS. Second, we would like to specifically include in the definition of a victim insurance carriers and crime victims, or actually the criminal with injuries compensation account, so that there will be no confusion as to whether or not those entities can be included as payees of a restitution award. And then finally, a minor correction in the bill, when the bill is speaking of the order of payment, it states that the criminal injuries compensation account may be reimbursed if the fund is listed in the judgment. It has been our experience that the fund is rarely listed in that manner. It can be listed in a hundred different ways, the Department of Justice, crime victims, all sorts of different types of ways of wording it. In addition, the fund sometimes is not listed at all as a payee because the district attorney that is proposing the restitution judgment does not yet know that crime victims has paid the victim. We would propose adding something along the lines that the fund may be reimbursed if the account has expended money on the victim's behalf. All that I have included in the hand-engrossed version. We would respectfully ask that the committee not move to work session today so that we may get these amendments back before the committee. Thank you. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Right, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, would you go through just again the priority, the victim, and then you talked about, is it the criminal injuries compensation account? And what's all encompassed in that, Now, why is that a priority compared to any other one who received an injury?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is a correct statement of the priority. It is the actual victim of the crime, the crime, criminal injuries compensation account, and then all others who suffered an economic loss. The Restitution Reform Task Force placed that ordering placed the criminal injuries compensation account as second because it is actually a revolving account, that money that comes in then goes right back out to help further victims. So it was a consideration of the task force that they made the prior to that type of money, since it comes in and then goes out to further assist victims, that be placed in the second priority, and then all others, which would be primarily insurance carriers, be placed in the third.
Further questions from the committee? Just a general observation. As I recall, the definition of economic damages under 31.710 is the one now commonly used in tort cases and refers only to objectively verifiable losses such as medical bills, hospital bills, nursing bills, medical expenses, that hospital expenses may be incurred by the victim. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is exactly the language.
Right. And so, again, in making this change, we're not defining or allowing any compensation for pain and suffering. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that's no change in the present law?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
All right, fine. Further questions from the committee?
Yes,
Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson.
In the last session, we passed an expanded restitution of victims bill, as I recall, one that if quantifies all the damages that were caused by a victim's misconduct and impose that as an obligation, that there's a judgment entered against the convicted offender. So that what this does, in addition to the other clarifications you described, but I want to make sure I'm understanding it, is to make it clear that the amount that an offender would be obligated to repay would include not only the damage to the individual victim of the criminal conduct, but if there were, for example, property damage to a vehicle or a home that was covered by an insurer, that would become part of the judgment that offender would be obligated to repay. Is that a correct understanding?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, correct. That is exactly what it's intended to do, in that we had the Restitution Reform Task Force had anecdotal evidence that in certain counties, in that exact situation, for example, if someone's car was stolen, it was covered by insurance, there was a deductible of $200, but the car was worth $10,000, that restitution would be awarded for the $200, not for the full value of the car, even though the insurance company had paid for the full value of the car. What this, in the view of the task force, was a windfall for the criminal defendant, that they did not have to pay the full amount of the loss. What this does is clarify so that in that situation, the full amount of the loss would be payable in the restitution judgment.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Berger, what proportion of all the restitution judgments by offenders are actually recovered? And if you don't have precise statistics, do you have a ballpark?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I may defer to my colleague, Mr. Barber, from the Crime Victims Section.
Good transition into your testimony, Mr. Barber. You want to state your name for the record, please?
Sure. My name is Jason Barber. I'm the Assistant Director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section and in charge of the day-to-day operations of the Crime Victim Compensation Program. I can give you kind of a microism look based on our department. We have two revenue agents, an in-house collection program within Crime Victims Comp. We collect about 12% back from what we pay out on crime victim claims. I'm not sure if that would follow over to the rest of the state, but that's kind of what, where we're at.
We have a follow-up question to that, but if you had testimony you wanted to present, otherwise, why don't you go ahead with that, and then I could follow up later.
Go ahead, Mr. Barber.
Basically, with the Crime Victims Comp Program, we receive approximately 5,500 claims per year, roughly 460 claims a month from victims of violent crime all across the state of Oregon. Annually, we pay out about $3.3 million for their crime-related out-of-pocket expenses, and we feel this bill would support crime victims in basically the exact three ways that Mr. Boss has alluded to. We feel that'd be a nice complement to Senate Bill 617, which is the bill that Representative McPherson was alluding to that was passed last session, which requires courts to order full restitution of victims without regard of the offender's ability to pay. We feel the clarification and the definition of damages would help increase the victim's chances of recovering their full recovery, economic losses. Number two, again, it gives victims the payment priority, the actual victim that the crime occurred to. And number three, the clarification of third-party payers being able to receive restitution. And this would particularly help out the Crime Victim Assistance Section in the fact that, again, we've got two revenue agents. Last year, we paid out $3.3 million. Those two positions were able to collect over $410,000 back from offenders and other responsible third parties. So we feel that the third party element to this bill would enhance their ability to collect monies. And that basically concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Representative McPherson, did you have additional questions?
Mr. Barber, you said that the $3.3 million last year, is that a fiscal?
Calendar year.
Calendar year. In calendar 2004, then, I assume. I realize it's hard maybe to segregate costs, but how much do we spend on the effort to try to collect those restitution judgments?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I don't have those figures in front of me. There are two Revenue Agent 1 positions. So whatever the personnel and services, administrative cost for those two positions would be, plus, I know we have a few collection databases that we subscribe to and pay out. I'm positive that both of those positions are revenue generating. They collect quite a bit more than the cost of what it costs to employ them. So they're revenue generating positions.
The policy issue Mr. Chair, I'm wrestling with here is that we have gaining or recovering restitution payments from offenders. My sense of it is it's a fairly low productivity effort. That is, people criminal offenders aren't usually good for the judgments that are entered against them, and that would be reflected in that first statistic we heard, that 12% of restitution is being actually recovered. And so what I'm getting at here is it a productive thing to be including the damages that are being incurred by third-party insurers in the restitution judgment and making them part of what you do to try to recover that money when it's not going to the sort of innocent victim of crime. It's going to an institutional provider of risk management, that's an insurer in the typical case, who has undertaken a risk as part of a cost of doing business. Does that make sense to add this on to our victims' restitution recovery process?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did have this debate in the Restitution Reform Task Force, and I think we have two things I can tell you about it. Number one, it was our feeling that the criminal defendant should be held, accept responsibility for their actions and full responsibility for their actions. And by the happen, if the victim had the happenstance of having insurance or not having insurance, that would detract from the defendant's ability to accept full responsibility for their actions. So that's more of a philosophical standpoint of the task force. Number two, as a collection attorney myself, I can tell you that it really depends. It's not across the board 12%. Even the most desperate and criminals who are in the state pen quite often usually have responsible parents who leave them an inheritance. People win the lottery. It is something that you simply cannot predict when people will have money, when they will inherit the family farm, when they will be able to be held responsible. And the most frustrating thing is when you do have a defendant who has perpetuated a crime and it's cost X, they have the ability to pay, but then the restitution is only ordered at a very low level. When truly the harm to society and the harm was at a higher level. So I can, from my experience as a collection attorney in these particular judgments, I can tell you you really can't predict what it will be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, further questions?
Yes, please.
Looking to my far left, Representative Jarn.
Mr. Barber, what is the extent of powers of collection that your staff possess? Is it equivalent to the Internal Revenue Service, or do you have extra powers of collection? Or
since we have our Chair Ackerman and Representative Garrard, I'd probably defer that to Mr. Boss here, since he is our collection attorney. But we do have the power to garnish liens. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not like the Internal Revenue Service. We have the full powers of a civil creditor.
Mr. Chair,
I think that means that you have a civil judgment for restitution against the offending defendant. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, actually, no. We have a criminal judgment. It is by statute you can use the full powers as of the civil collection effort.
And it's a judgment from which a collection emanates, garnishment, levies on property, things of that nature.
Correct.
Fine. Thank you. Further questions of these two witnesses? We have one witness waiting. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either Mr. Boss or Mr. Barber, in the priority of the repayment and not specifically focusing on the administrative costs and the balance of what is recovered, but the initial payment goes to the victim in the order of priority. And when that amount has been fully paid, the clerk shall transfer monies to the criminal injuries compensation account. When that amount is fully paid, then it would go to other victims. Is there ever an instance where there are awards that are fully paid?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, we do have a lot of success stories in our collection unit of getting full payment on several criminal money judgments.
And follow up?
Yes, you may.
Then can you quantify a lot?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, I don't have specific numbers, but again, last calendar year, our revenue agents collected $410,000, roughly. Between the two of them, I think that works out to about $35,000 a month. But I do not have numbers with me with exactly how many criminal money judgments get paid in full.
Follow up?
Yes, you may.
So I guess what I'm trying to determine is that victims in this order of priority would be fully compensated, and going to the second level and then to the tertiary level, you expect that there would be full compensation in each one of those particular columns.
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, Correct. Our revenue agents do collect the full money judgment, not just our portion. So when we collect on cases and they're closed as payment in full, then everyone listed on the judgment as a payee has been paid, which means the victim, possibly us, all of the unitary assessment, whatever other fees are listed on there.
Okay, thank you. Further questions for the committee? If not, we'll excuse the proponents, and we have Brad Swank from the court system, I believe in opposition, or neutral, I suppose. Neutral, I read it wrong.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, representatives, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm here today not to oppose the bill, but because we haven't taken a substantive position on the bill, but to mention some things to you. Some of them I just discovered this morning, but one of them, we are working on a fiscal impact on this bill. We have not completed the fiscal impact yet. One of the things that the bill does is it establishes priorities within Category 2, and you should recognize that there are four categories of payments under a criminal judgment bill that go through clerk, and they are prioritized in statute, and this change would prioritize one of those categories within the four categories. And it is not something that, I don't know whether our computer system currently has the capability of establishing those priorities on a statewide basis. We have 26 different court locations that we would have to, if it requires reprogramming of this part of the Oregon Judicial Information Network, to have to program and roll out a computer system. And I had to send the request to our techies last week to have them look at it and see whether it requires reprogramming. If it requires substantial reprogramming, there may be a substantial cost connected with that, because you have to develop the program and then roll it out to 26 different sites, and you start with the alpha testing, then you do the beta testing, and it takes a while to do that and costs some money. If the system doesn't currently has the capability of doing that, there would be no cost, but we thought you should know whether there's a cost before you roll this out and pass this bill, and so I'm here to inform you that we're working on it, and we'll let you know when we figured out whether there will be a cost. The second thing I wanted to mention is under the proposed amendments that I saw this morning for the first time that Mr. Boss presented on page 5, they've got an interesting amendment in line 11. We would like some time to talk to the Attorney General's office about that particular amendment. It appears that, and I could be wrong about this, but we'd like to talk to them. What happens when criminal judgment comes down and there are monies in a money award that have been made, we enter this in our computer system based on what the judgment says, what the actual paper says that the judge signed, because that's an official act of the court. And then when the money comes in, the computer sets up the priorities according to what's established in statute, and then the clerk pays those monies out as the computer tells them to in the priorities that have been set up by statute. If I understand the change that's being made on page 5 of the Hand and Gross Amendments, lines 11 and 12, it appears that there would be anticipation that a payment would be made to the criminal injuries compensation account for something that is not in the judgment itself, which would be problematic. We don't want clerks in our courts sort of making independent decisions about money to be paid out if it's not set forth in the judgment, because the judgment is the official document that controls the actions of the courts and the relationships of the party. If that is the effect of that amendment, that would be problematic for us, because we would have clerks not following the formal written legal decision of the court as to how monies were to be paid out, and so we would like to work with the Attorney General's office to clear that up. Those are the two things that I have about this, and I can answer any questions that you've got about our position on this bill or what we're doing with it and looking at it, or other aspects of OGIN or payments that the courts do. I'd also like to mention that Mr. Barber and Mr. Boss's shop, in fact, do not do all of the collections on restitution. In fact, in 1999, the legislature authorized a statewide collections program through the courts, and it's the first time that has been authorized. That program was delayed somewhat in 2002 and 2003 when budget cuts caused us to shut down the program and to lay people off in the courts, and we've managed to get that program going again this spring. But we use both the Department of Revenue and third-party collectors independent private collectors to collect on criminal judgments that where awards are made. And for some of those criminal judgments, the criminal injuries compensation people do collections on ones that they've identified as being important. But on the rest of them, the collections effort is an effort that's made now through the courts. When I first started with the Judicial Department years and years, seems like a long time ago, it was the district attorneys who did collections, but their resources have been stressed. And so in the end of the 90s, the courts sought the legislature's assistance to pick that up, and recently we've got that effort going. There are also a number of collections for restitution and other parts of criminal judgments that are done by the courts. So if you've got any questions, I can answer them. Otherwise, we'd like some time on this bill to work with the Attorney General's office and get some numbers to the legislative fiscal people on whether or not this would cost us money.
Okay. It looks like this bill's going to go too far today, but I'd like to get as many questions out as we can now so that if we have to go back to the public hearing, we can narrow the scope of the hearing and move on the bill. Questions of Mr. Swank? Okay. Hearing none, you're excused. Thank you. And counsel?
Chair, I commend members of the committee. Kelly Skye called me this morning. She's with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. She's not able to make it because she has the flu, but she has submitted testimony. All of you have been provided that testimony.
Thank you. Since it looks like this bill has to come back, I would invite the participants in today's discussion to confer on the Dash 1 amendments and hope that you can bring something back that's acceptable. Since we don't have the full fiscal impact, I think we should continue the public hearing for that purpose. And I would also like to have Kelly Skye testify during the next public hearing. So I think this will go off today. I'll conclude the public hearing. We will not go into work session. The bill will be reset when the information requested has been represented to the committee. Further business for the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.